from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Amisha Cross, Teo Hardeman, Hermaine Hartman, and Celine Muwakil. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And if you want to join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, it is beyondthebeltway.com each and every Sunday night. There are about 50 days to go before the big election, and we'll be talking about the election as the program unfolds this evening, specifically as it relates to the appeal of the candidates in the African-American communities around the United States. But, of course, the big news at this moment is what happened last night in New York City. There was a bombing. It was a pressure cooker bomb, and there were 29 people, no one killed, but 29 people injured. They discovered another bomb several blocks away from the bomb that was detonated. And then earlier in the day, there had been an incident in New Jersey. And all this was happening in New York City. And obviously, the United Nations is ready to congregate this week. So again, it has raised the possibility of a terrorist attack, although in this particular case, there is no link at this moment to international terrorism. However, there was an incident at a shopping mall in Minnesota where 8 people were knifed. And again, the perpetrator of that crime yelled out Allah before he was killed by local police. That was in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I want to begin with our guest this evening, and the topic of tonight's program, the broader topic, is the politics of life in the inner cities in America. But as you know, because we do this program from Chicago, I have shared with you the epidemic of violence we've had in the city. And again, just talking about shootings all over the United States, the record this year for shootings in the city of Chicago, there are 3,099 shootings thus far in this city. Compared to a year ago, there was a total of 2,988 in the entire year. Insofar as murders are concerned, in 2016, 524 people have been murdered in Chicago thus far. Last year, the entire year, 491. And 31 people have been murdered in this city just this month. And usually the statistics for crime and shooting in Chicago comes out on a Monday. So I would suspect that it will not be alarming if when the results come out tomorrow, there will be 10 more people who were murdered in Chicago just this weekend. Hermaine Hartman, you are one of our guests, and I want to get your reaction to the epidemic of violence in Chicago. But I want to put it in the context to what happened in New York. Everyone on the panel this evening is a leader in the African-American community. How do African-Americans react to bombings in other cities, especially when those cities are being described as acts of terrorism, when many African-Americans who live in Chicago feel that they live in a war zone and are victims of terrorism every day?
Bruce, I think we have become immune to the terrorism, to the murders, to the scenes. There are simple things in Chicago that we are no longer able to do. Water your lawn. 6-year-old sit on the porch with grandfather. Play in the play lot. And people are beginning to move from this city, particularly people with young black boys. They're beginning to move. So I think because the news media, if we watch how they report, reporting is done in I call scoreboard way. 10 this weekend, 15 this weekend, 2 in Woodlawn, 3 in Lawndale, 2 in Inglewood. So I think we've become immune. I think the point is, though, that we are living in a violent society. These kids are violent. Black ones, white ones, green ones, suburban ones, urban ones, they are violent, and they react violently, and that is the way they deal.
Amisha Cross also joins us. Amisha, your answer to the question about how African-Americans view reports of terrorism in other domestic cities like what's happening in New York?
I think that it's completely separate. I think that the majority of the African-American population views terrorism as something that is typically done by an outside force, someone who is typically non-American, someone who is against American ideals. When you're talking about what's going on in the inner city, these people look just like us. They grew up in our neighborhoods. They went to our schools. So it's an entirely different type of situation. Also, when you're looking at random acts of terrorism, they occur in a very small number in comparison to what's happening literally on the daily in a lot of the communities of color across the country.
Teal Hardeman also joins us. He is with a group called Violence Interrupters, and you work with people who are involved in violence in a variety of different ways. Yes. What is your reaction to the startling statistics that we have in this city?
Well, my reaction first is violence should be treated as a public health emergency worldwide, because people learn violent behavior. You know, it's passed on from generation to generation, and we all have a responsibility, Bruce, in helping to reduce the levels of violence in the African American community. And the reason I say African American because in Chicago, 85% to 90% of the killings do occur in the African-American community. We African-American leaders must step up to the plate and deal with their own people right now. We have to stop waiting on federal resources. We have to stop waiting on community programs, and men in particular, and women, but mainly the men. It's mandatory for men to address their own relatives.
Salim Mukil also joins us, longtime guest in this program, senior editor of In These Times, also a talk show host for WVON Radio. Salim, what's happening and how can it be alleviated?
Chronic poverty is criminogenic, and we've seen this situation in our communities for generations. And people who live on the edge of survival have a difficult time trying to manage these kinds of these personal conflicts, and that's primarily what's going on. The social contract has broken down in many of our communities because so many people are on the edge of survival. And if you look at the violence in Chicago and correlate it with poverty and wealth disparities, you can make a pretty
Bruce,
close correlation.
We never get to the core, and that's the problem, and that's what Salim is talking about. We talk about the violence, but we don't talk about the cause of the violence, and poverty is the cause. There's a correlation between the neighborhoods and the poverty level and the crime level.
Absolutely.
Those have direct correlations. Now, violence is everywhere,
but not everyone who lives below the poverty line
is violent.
Is violent.
That's right.
And
that's right.
And they're not even criminal. I'm trying to go even deeper than that, Teal.
Well, let me say this. 2016 is the year of the renegades when it comes down to all the violence. It's a lot of interpersonal conflict taking place in Chicago. Brother Salim made it clear. A lot of people do not know how to deal with their interpersonal issues. So it leads to violence. That's why Chicago is so bad right now. But this is nothing new for Chicago. I looked at the homicide rate back all the way to 1928. You had 400-plus homicides in 1928 in Chicago.
With Al Capone?
Yeah, with Al Capone. So the reality of it is that we have a chronic problem in Chicago, systemic problem, which needs to be addressed as a public health issue.
I want to talk more about that. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight we're talking about crime and punishment and what's happening in the African-American communities around the United States or in poverty communities around the United States. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
Historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Misha Cross, you were going to make a point between growing up in a rural community. You were born in Chicago but grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, as opposed to growing up in Chicago.
Right. And my argument is and will always remain that poverty isn't the main driver for violence. I don't even think that it's in the top 10 drivers for violence. There are, within this nation, particularly in the southern region of the country, poverty is a lot higher, to the tune of 3 to 4 times higher than it is in the city of Chicago, than it is in Detroit, than it is in a lot of other urban centers. Yet you do not see violence at the level that you do here. So I don't think that it's that. What I do believe is an issue, even more so, is the breakdown of the family, the breakdown of the community, people who would be able to tell you where your children were, grandparents who were actively involved in the children's lives, people who had a intricate community relationship where neighbors knew what was going on, they knew the names of the kids down the street, these people who also served as accountability markers for parents while the parents were working 2 to 3 jobs. Poverty has always existed in the black community.
What are those other markers? Does everybody agree with what Amisha just said?
Not exactly. Okay, I think there's some nuances here. You read William Joyce Wilson's book, The Truly Disadvantaged, and he talks about the changes in the employment patterns in Chicago and how those patterns are directly correlated with increases in violence. The marriageable male, the fact that those are the part of the reasons for the family breakdown that Amisha talks about. And all of those affect our levels of violence and criminal behavior.
Well, see, the family breakdown is major because right now 7 out of 10 African-American families do not have their fathers. That data is out there. The reality is there's a strong family breakdown that needs to be addressed by the people in the community.
Why is that?
Well, it's a lot of reasons why, Bruce, because you got to look at
the
infiltration of drugs in the African-American community, the fall of the Black Panther Party. I'm talking about going back now because those were organizations that were standing up for the African-American community, like the vanguards of the community. Drugs were purposely placed in the African-American community, and I'm not looking at no conspiracy theory here, but the thing is, the illegal gun trafficking, and most guys that grew up in certain neighborhoods want to dominate their surrounding. You had the proliferation of the building of the big strong gangs in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s, and one mystery nobody deals with. See, everybody's in response mode, which means everybody comes after somebody gets killed. Nobody's talking about how we stop it on the front end. The police, and I'm not criticizing the police, but the police should be serve and respond because they come after a crime is committed. Most of the community groups come after somebody's been shot as well. A lot of people made good names for themselves in the media off the tragedies of other people. Bottom line, Bruce, crime pays. Everybody's making money off the crime. The funeral homes, the justice system, the penitentiaries, and the list goes on and on. So there's a bigger issue behind the crime.
Tell us the difference, in your view, the difference between the large gangs in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in this city and all of the United States.
Right.
How are the gangs of the 70s and 80s, how do they differ from what's happening now?
Well, you have cliques now. You don't have nobody really calling shots on these young guys. It's the year of the renegades. Guys can do whatever they feel like doing. That's the biggest difference. You have some guys that might run 10 blocks or 2 blocks. It used to be a time you had nations back in the Blackstone Nation, Gangs of Disciple Nation, or the Latin King Nation. That doesn't exist anymore the way it used to be. Okay, now when these guys get locked up, they have to become a part of a nation when they get locked up, because you can't do that renegade stuff when you're in a penitentiary. But on the streets, all bets are off. You can do what you want to do.
But isn't some of that from when you had CHA and you had Robert Taylor Holmes, that those buildings had designation? Mm-hmm. And then when that dissolved, you've got scattered housing. And that means that the structure, the culture is gone, is eliminated in what you're calling, I guess,
well,
renegade.
The police helped that as well. When they went after, they had a specific program to go after the leadership, the gang leadership. And they locked up many, many leaders of these leading organizations. And then that left them bereft of any kind of guidance. And so we have a lot of young cats who don't really know how to act. And they're just acting on many of their impulses. And that's part of
it.
I just want to make sure. So you're suggesting that as the police crack down on gang leadership, it leaves the followers undisciplined?
Yes, indeed.
Within the structure.
That's an interesting argument. As a veteran young person around the table, I think
And your father is from law enforcement.
Yes.
Okay.
And I actually run the police.
Others in your family, right?
So it's very interesting to me when I hear people say that without certain things that this generation of gangs would be different. First and foremost, we're not seeing gang leaders. What we're seeing is factions. And within those factions, you may have a gang group of 3 or 4 people. Those three or four people are running an entire group of blocks. Those three or four people don't necessarily have the same ideology as those of the Blackstone Rangers. They don't have the same framework. And it's not about leadership as much as it is about taking control and feeling dominant of something. It's about being able to pass along a product and get money from that product and instill fear in people.
Is it similar to what we're seeing on the world stage between ISIS and Al Qaeda?
I think it is a lot more similar to their roots than it is their outcomes.
So you have to understand one thing, Bruce. A lot of these killings are not really gang motivated. A lot of people are being killed because of reputation, a guy that just feels like he does not want to be bullied or victimized, and some guys are killing because they want to get a body count. But I talk to these young guys on a regular basis.
Isn't some of it initiation?
Some of the lightweight initiation in some cases or another. But right now, guys are killing because they want to be the first one to shoot first. And shoot first, ask questions later. No one wants to be victimized. That's why you got kids being shot, older women being shot, older men being shot. Because right now,
innocent
a lot of people have lost their
innocent
bystanders. Yeah. Well, you got to understand. Look at Tyshawn Lee for a quick minute here. Tyshawn Lee was executed.
Tell everybody around the country about that case.
Tyshawn Lee was a 9-year-old that was executed in the Auburn Gresham community on the south side of Chicago. His father, basically, allegedly now, had shot another guy and shot the guy's mother. He killed the guy's brother. The alleged person that killed Tyshawn Lee, the father of Tyshawn Lee, allegedly had shot the guys, killed his brother and shot his mother. In the mind, the thinking of the guys that executed Tyshawn, because the guy was in the Cook County Jail saying that Shorty couldn't take it no more. He told somebody in the jail that. So it goes to show you, I understand the mindset. The mindset is not right, but these guys wanted revenge for the guy shooting his mother. And so you got, these were cliques. These were not no gang orders or nothing like that. These were cliques that carried out this particular execution of a 9-year-old.
The majority of the gun shootings, the gang violence shootings in Chicago are not retaliation, though. So one of the most recent shootings, which was three blocks from my house, was actually a student who got sent home from school because he wasn't wearing a bow tie as part of his school uniform. He got shot two blocks in front of the school in a drive-by. Had nothing to do with the young man. He wasn't involved in any gang affiliation or anything. A lot of the seniors in our communities who die, a lot of the young people in our communities who die, they're not dying as a piece of retaliation because of something they did.
Well, I have to differ with you on that, young lady. Let me just make this clear. The good majority of the shootings are retaliation shootings. A lot of these young men out here are shooting because their friends have been killed, and that's why they shoot innocent people, because they're trying to shoot people.
I want to make sure that I'm hearing your interpretation of the escalating violence. So that if I'm home watching television every night and I'm watching the 10 o'clock news and a shooting or a murder in Chicago leads the news 4 out of 5 nights.
Right.
And usually the story is that some innocent bystander has been shot, whether it's a 6-year-old child or a grandmother sitting on a porch. What I'm hearing you say is that what is not in that first report and may not be in the report the next day is that that person may not be an innocent victim. Somewhere in the trail of that family, there may be someone who caused retaliation.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that you hear the stories about little kids being shot. 9 times out of 10, the guys are shooting at somebody else, but they end up shooting a little kid. Tyshawn Lee was a different case. They straight up went to kill him out of retaliation, what his father may have done. Okay. Now, the little girl that was shot in Inglewood recently, they were shooting on the block at somebody else in retaliation. She survived. She went to the hospital. She was released.
So she was an accident.
Right. No, she got shot. Now, another young lady got shot over there. I forget the young lady's name. So sorry about that. But she was shot. She went to the hospital. She was released. But they shot at her uncle and killed him, and they accidentally shot her.
Okay. And again, for those listening around the country, we're talking a lot about what's happening in Chicago, so I want to kind of broaden the discussion to engage everyone. But a question that I would have is, we're talking about this, is who in the African-American community is teaching right from wrong and that there is value in the human life?
Everybody.
Well, everybody's teaching that. But let me answer that question differently. Mm-hmm. We have a violent culture, okay? These kids, have you looked at the games that these kids are playing? It's shoot. If you shoot the head off, you get 10 points. You shoot the arm, you get 3 points. Mm-hmm. We are raising a group of violent people. Black ones, white ones, suburban ones, urban ones, educated ones, not educated ones, so on and so forth. So if you see violence, you look at TV. Our entertainment is violent. what we look at, what our children look at to be entertained is violence. So what they get psychologically is the solution to my problem is to shoot somebody. That's how you deal with conflict resolution. Who's teaching not to do that? Everybody's teaching not to do that. The teacher, the preacher, the counselor, the neighbor next door. Nobody's telling these kids to go shoot somebody. Now, I think you also have to look at guns in our community.
Do you include that? Because I don't want to get Salim. Do you include in that rap music? Because Salim,
yes, it's
about
violent.
Rap. Salim, your thought on the role of some of the popular culture elements that Hermine just mentioned.
Well, you know, if exhorting people to do right worked, we would be angels. There's so many churches on the corners in black communities, and often the more impoverished the community is, the more churches you see. So everybody's exhorting black people to act morally. But you can't exhort people to act when they're on the edge of survival. That's the point I'm making. And when Hermine is talking about this cultural violence in our society, it manifests itself differently in the white community. You know, most of the gun violence in this country is suicides, white people committing suicide.
Let me ask mm-hmm. this question though. You say the difference because you're talking about the white community. All communities, their kids are involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
If you're growing up black, you say that someone has told you not to do it, but is there a strong difference between right and wrong?
Absolutely.
And does that go back to the family? And is that the big difference, that there are more absentee fathers in African-American homes?
Well, when you have the struggle to find resources, lectures about right and wrong are not that compelling.
All right, I want to get a reaction on that. We also have callers on the line, 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast, border to border, now around the world on beyondthebeltway.com. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Joe is listening to us tonight on KLBJ. Go ahead, Joe.
Thanks, Bruce. Great program as usual.
Thank you.
First, let me give you a statistic. Blacks are about 13% of the population, U.S. population, but they commit 65% of the violent crimes. Now, this statistic is shocking, and what it means is that the police have a lot of interaction with young black people committing violent crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, you get Black Lives Matter, who think the police are picking on black people. But it's really, the fact is, the black community is inundating our cities with violent crime. Now, why? I think the lady on the panel that talks about the family is, I think that she's hitting the nail on the head. I think the breakup of the black family is the reason for all these problems, especially a lack of, if you want to say, religious focus. What we have is a government focus in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like, what government program can we apply to the black community? What government money can we spend in the black community? That seems to be, and that's been for the last 30 years,
Joe, stay on the line. You make a good point. Stay on the line. I'm going to give you a chance to respond to it. But let's let our guest, we'll start with Amisha. I think she's the person that you referenced.
First off, thanks for your call. I don't actually have too much against what you said. I will say that for one, when it comes to police officers in the black community feeling like they have been targeted, blacks are often stopped by police regardless of whether they are in violent communities or black areas at all. That's just the way it is in this nation. I will say, however, though, I do believe that the breakdown of the African-American family has a direct causation when it comes to the rise in violence, particularly as it relates to the black males not being at home with kids. Because we know that the black male influence on a young black man is extremely important. It's extremely important in guiding them. As much as I love my mom also raised two sons. And I think that it is very difficult for a woman to be able to teach a man to be a man, specifically a black man who will walk through this life and have to go through things that we as black women will never feel and never have to go through. Mm. I think that it is very important that we recognize that it matters to have that source within the family. And I think that today that's something that we just don't see. And it's something that the black community, to be honest, because we've gone so long without it at this point, doesn't necessarily put the weight on it that needs to be there.
Tio, speak to the point. Why are so many black families without a male figure, a father figure?
Well, mass incarceration, drug addiction, the list goes on and on. We have some serious problems in that.
Pause. Let me just, yes. Because they committed a crime.
Well, let me say this, Bruce. Let me just be straight up with you. I play the devil's advocate every now and then, okay? There's a book by a writer named A.J. Diamond. It's called Mean Streets. He exposes the evolution of Chicago street gangs all the way back to the Irish, the Polish, the Jews, and everybody. I'm just telling you how my ancestors had to fight over around the stockyard area around Sox Park just to be accepted as far as working jobs back then.
Yeah, but
athletic clubs.
I'm going to just stop you for a second.
Yeah,
just, because
that's
fine. I want to zero in on it.
Yeah.
There are black men who are not in their families because they're in prison. They are in prison because they committed a crime. Now, we can argue as to whether or not the sentencing was a disparity. I can agree with that. But the fact is, black men created crime and they went to prison instead of being with their families.
Well,
is that a fact that you can acknowledge?
No, I wouldn't acknowledge that fact, Bruce.
Why not?
I won't do it because there's a lot of factors, variables that go into the background of that.
Like such?
Drug addiction. And then what you might say, drugs are planted in the African-American community. Sincerely, all right? I want to make that clear. It's proven. That's been proven. Gary Webb, the guy that they filmed a movie, Don't Kill the Messenger, he exposed how the CIA was planting drugs in the African-American community. And a lot of young men that are out there on the streets, they get caught up in that vicious cycle for a lot of different reasons. Some of the brothers on the streets, believe it or not, came from good families. I just want to make that clear.
So
you got some guys out there.
Would you acknowledge that some African-American men acted irresponsibly?
Without a doubt. You know, we have to say that the same way a lot of people act irresponsibly.
I mean, what would you add to
the
reasons for the breakdown in the family?
I would say the family's broken down, but I'd say the social structure has broken down. It's not just the family. The family is the core, and it is key. But there are other things that have broken down, too. You used to go to church every Sunday. I don't care where if you were poor, if you were rich, if you were whatever. You went to church every single Sunday, and you may have stayed in church all day long.
As a family?
As a family, but particularly as a kid, as you went to Sunday school. You used to have Boy Scouts in the church. You used to have Girl Scouts in the church. You had that taught you certain things. The gangs replaced the Boy Scouts. Okay, the gangs replace the Boy Scouts. Kids need to belong to something. You go through the black community.
When did that happen, Hermaine?
I think we're about 20 years out. I think that's 20 years. When I was a kid, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, that was part of belonging to the church. That was part of the socialization. You had dancing classes. You had sports. Boys played basketball. You didn't necessarily have a basketball court, but you played in the alley.
Shalim, what would you add to this?
Family, right?
I would add what Hermine is saying is true. Much of that was because we had more economic viability. I mean, there's a lot of scholarship on this, Bruce, a lot of scholarship that makes the point that jobs just disappeared. Black people are here because we were attracted to industrial jobs that disappeared, were gone. And when jobs are gone, I heard the caller talk about the government intrudes. Well, the government intruded in 1933. The Civilian Conservation Corps, its main purpose was to hire unemployed men, any unemployed man. That was its job, and that's what the government did that and saved the American middle class.
I think the caller was also trying to get at.
I guess, but what What responsibility would you put on the black individual man for the destruction of the family and the social fabric that we're talking about?
I would put a lot of personal responsibility on people who commit crimes and destroy their community, but I also would put it in context, because as humans we have to understand things in a contextual
right.
way. We all black people want the same thing that white people want. They want their children to have the potential of expressing their God-given gifts. They want their societies, their schools to be effective. They want clean streets. The same thing everyone else wants.
Has
and if they don't have them, it's a reason for it. There's a purpose.
Looking at something we've talked about, the government does too much, mm-hmm. maybe or tries to do too much for the black community. Are there federal programs that you can point to that really have hurt the cause? I want to talk about at least the impression that I had insofar as public housing is concerned, is that federal policy
right.
forced a lot of men out of the house.
Oh, yeah.
What was the economic
That's right.
reason
that? Was public
for that?
Policy. That was, well, that was a public policy factor.
What was the do-good thought in that?
Well,
I don't know. You have to ask the people who put that together. I don't know what the do-good thought was. It was a dumb
housing.
Thought to me.
Ta-Nehisi Coates addressed this in an Atlantic article in which he talks about the failure of housing in the black community, the black family in this particular point in history.
The housing has been...
Let me put a... I don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but when Donald Trump says that big city democratic, he doesn't use the word machines.
That's what he means.
When big city democratic machines created policies that affected the African-American community, it made them more beholden to the Democratic Party. And again, in this particular case, those policies – part of the war on poverty policy. We're going back to the 60s, even late 50s.
Yeah. Let's go back to the New Deal. Let's go back to the New Deal.
So I'm just saying,
a lot of people supported Roosevelt.
So does everybody agree that that is at least part of the systemic problem, if that's where men started to walk out on their families?
Well, I said this earlier on your show. See, we as a people, speak for African-American people, we need to stop waiting on federal programs anyway. I think it's incumbent upon African-American men to step up and address the issues of crime in their community. I want to make that clear. I'm a product of the Henry Horner Projects mm-hmm. on the West Side. And there was a time when I remember mothers could not have a man living with them because they would lose their benefits of being in public housing and they would lose part of their welfare check. So the men had to hide in the closets and all that kind of stuff. So it diminished the role of some males in the families back
then. But that was a federal policy.
Right, that was a federal policy. Right, exactly.
A federal policy that was designed to, and I'm not a proponent of this policy, but just to put it in context, as we were talking about earlier, a federal policy that was designed to make sure that African-American males had jobs. Because what they saw was that there were women who were trying to get by, meanwhile having kids and taking care of them, but the man was not supporting them in any way. So what you ended up having was a lot of men who would not be included on the roster when these women were applying for this housing.
Right, right.
And these men were not being beneficial in any way. Again, they didn't have jobs. They weren't in school. So why are they? These are adult males.
Also, when you lived in public housing, it was a collective percentage of everyone who lived in that house. That's how your rent was determined.
Exactly.
And in many cases, especially in Chicago with the Robert Taylor homes, which were gone, these were dilapidated federal housing and projects that they were crime infested. People did survive in them. But again, this was revealing in an interview I did almost 30 years ago, is that if you had three or four working people in one apartment, you could be paying $1,600, $1,800 a month.
Exactly.
To live in a poverty building that was rife with crime.
Let's add the
and
race.
You couldn't move, and at that point, because of the segregation of housing, you couldn't move that family to a nicer neighborhood or a nicer home because your past address was the Robert Taylor homes and nobody would rent to you.
But let's add the race factor.
Yes.
That was segregated housing.
Yes, it was.
That was concentrated housing.
Created by the federal
government.
Created
by the federal government. That was to maintain a social class. That was to maintain economics. And most of all, it was to maintain a political
voting
system.
Send out the turkeys on Election Day.
Mm-hmm. Or hams.
Or hams. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Lots of calls coming up.
Good.
Exactly.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Spumont back in Chicago. Hermaid, I want you to put on the record what we talked about just before during the commercial break. You were asking the question about if men are out of the black families, as we've talked about, why are there still so many black babies? Because the men are around sometimes.
I can't answer because I don't agree. But I don't agree with the premise that the man is gone. See, I don't agree with that because he couldn't be gone. I'll come into the house or come into whatever my housing is with one child, and then 4 years later, I got four more. That somebody is home. And I think the man is home. Now, you had a government situation, a government public policy that forced black men. Go back to the Monahan report. Mm-hmm. All right. Everybody got mad at Monahan, Daniel Monahan, when he wrote that report to say that we are forcing some of where we are today. Do you remember Dr. Effie Ellis?
No.
Dr. Effie Ellis was with the Kennedy administration. She was a doctor and she was here in Chicago and ran the urban. Mm-hmm. What was the thing Urban France ran?
Model cities,
and she was in that network. She talked early. This is 30 years ago, and Dr. Ellis talked about we would be where we are today. But these are the reasons that she stated. She said we were going to raise violent children. She said girls were having babies too early, that the body was not fully developed at 18, that you probably shouldn't have a baby until you're about 23, 25, because you weren't fully developed. She talked about the diet. She talked about feeding these kids potato chips for breakfast. She talked about the sugar in the diet and the cereal. She talked about the pop. And she talked about how that resulted not in brain damage, but it lessened learning. And she talked about these kids would be super hyper.
Not super predators,
but that they would be extremely hyper and that the teacher may not recognize what was going on and you would start giving these kids pills. You can look at a lot of these little black boys, 7, 8, 9 years old, they begin to give them, what's the pill?
Ritalin.
They could start giving them Ritalin at 9 years old. You can't do that to a kid. They can't fully develop. A lot of what we call violence with these kids is crack, heroin,
lead poisoning,
cocaine, lead poisoning, and so forth. There are other social conditions that these kids, and then they get mislabeled and they are almost doomed for life.
I want to go back a minute to this housing policy because we talked about it for a while. One of the things that consistently is left out of the housing policy argument that pushed minority males out of the home is that that policy lasted for a totality of 3 years. So it's very hard for me to believe that two generations later, when you're talking about 20 years, people are having kids, 17, 18, they at this point, those same people have grandkids. Why is it that the man is still outside of the home? So if this policy lasted only for that long in its enactment.
Where's your 3 years coming from?
From the HUD regulation. No, like there was a conversation around it, but the actual policy itself that made it illegal was 3 years long.
Yeah, but welfare policy also incorporated that stricture.
Exactly. But we were talking about housing.
Housing.
Well, you were making a point. We've talked a lot about the black males, but you say that black women have some responsibility here too.
Correct, because at the end of the day, if you're a single mom of one, that's one thing. If you're a single mom of four, that means you've repeated this thing three more times. At the end of the day, if you do not value yourself enough or have within yourself enough esteem to say I am worth more than this, then I am not going to take this from this gentleman. from this person who walks in and out of my life. That's a problem as a woman. And as long as we're not making ourselves more heard in our communities, telling these young men what we will or will not accept, then we're going to continually see men who walk all over.
But again, correct me if I'm wrong about the policy. The more children you have, it used to be that you would get more in your welfare checks, right?
Correct.
You're talking about a moral issue. We're talking also weighing that against a monetary issue.
Impracticality. Because we have to also look at the fact that a lot of these, I don't want to say a lot, but there are women who don't want to work and don't want to increase their lifestyle either. So they know that if I can bank on these kids, then there's no sense in changing that.
So what happened to marriage?
Tony and Kelly.
Where did marriage go?
That's a question I asked Black and
where did marriage go as opposed to my baby's mama?
Where did it go?
I don't know.
It wasn't just in the Black community. Well,
Black women.
Oh, no.
Black women
are. So I say it went to Woodstock. Free love killed it.
Okay.
Some of the issues that the African American community has faced with is too deep to talk about really on the show. I'll just be honest with you. And I'll say this right now, though. In 2016, the Civil War.
Why too deep?
Because it's a lot of factors that we can't really, because see, then people would look
at
me.
We need too much context.
We just need too much context for it. But sincerely, Bruce, the Civil War of 2016 is African American people reclaiming their youth. That's the new Civil War in the United States. African American men must step up to the plate. And I guarantee you, if I can organize 10,000 African American men here in Chicago for right now, I can reduce violence in Chicago by 90%.
Well, that's what the Million Man March was all about.
It's still going on.
Still going on. But Bruce, this is why you can't talk about it in a radio show.
Here we go.
The context, the Black family. This country destroyed the Black family as soon as we got here. It was destroyed on the boat. Mm. It was destroyed on the plantation. Mm. It was split then. Black folks couldn't get married. Black folks had to jump over a broom. Black folks got married, and then the family was destroyed intentionally. Take these two children, put them over there. Take these two, put them over here. Take these two and put them in the master's house. That we have had destruction by the government of our families ever since 1619.
But how do you get beyond the victimhood that you've described?
Victimhood. Well, that's racism.
It's racism. It's racism. It's victimhoods.
It's the government.
It's the government. I've already acknowledged the government. But again, the question I would ask, and for a lot of people listening to the program this evening, to them, you are describing things that began 150 years ago. What's happening now? We're talking about what's happening now
and
what
happening.
Can be changing. That's the question. But I got to take a couple of calls. Let's go to Tony in Calumet City. Go ahead. You're on the air. Tony, you there? You know what? We're running out of time. I'm going to we're going to put you on hold, Tony. Don't go away. We're about to break. It was my mistake. And when we come back, we have a full board of lights. They're coming from all over the country. They want to join in the discussion, and you can do as well. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back few years later, and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Beyond the Beltway continues from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's go to Kevin, listening to us in Cleveland out of WKBN. Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
My question is, why do you think black crime, black teenage crime, is so wildly disproportionate to white teenage crime?
Well, basically, you know, the African-American crime is all over the news all the time. We know that white teenage crime exists. There's no doubt about it. There's probably some big numbers in the white teenage crime as well. But right now, the news, that's all they cover is African-American people being shot and killed. That's the biggest difference.
But it's the perception.
It's not perception. These are the numbers, though, sir.
I think there's another issue here, and that's black people have been socialized to hate themselves throughout our history in this country. Socialized hatred of black. Afrophobia is what I call it. We tried to change our features, our phenotypic features, because we were taught that they were unpleasant and they were not attractive to the human.
But how about a basic lack of respect for another human being's life? I mean, we're getting into a lot of sociological stuff, which may be some accuracy, very important. But again, the point is, and by the way, I would disagree. I don't think to suggest that the level of crime in the white community is the same as it is in the black community. I don't think that's right at all.
No, I'm not saying it's not the same. All. I'm saying they have crime in the white community, but it's not covered as much.
They have, but they're not shooting 3,000 people.
Oh, no kind of way.
Go ahead, Kevin. Go ahead.
No kind of way.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, I've been reading books and I've been following the news that certain crimes are, like we hear about Chicago every day. But there's also another twist to the media here, though. Everyone knows who Michael Brown was, but most people don't know who Jessica Chambers was. So I think the media downplays a lot of black and white crimes. I think we're not getting a lot of that.
Right.
I agree. I think that's absolutely right. I think the reporting, I think you've got a bias in reporting in the news. Very most definitely. I call it scoreboard reporting. In Chicago, you have this weekend, Monday, 10 people were killed, 3 from Inglewood, 2 from Woodlawn. There is a difference in reporting when the crime is downtown Chicago. We just had in the last week, we've got a new way of doing crime. The kids drive the car through the window. And take whatever they got and grab. Okay, those are probably white stores. It's almost minor reporting because downtown doesn't want anybody to get too excited and stop shopping.
When that happens, that does make the news. And again, if there's an interracial incident, it does get covered. It probably gets more covered if an African-American has been killed by a white or by a white police officer. We certainly know that's the case. But this is what's happening in Chicago right now, by the way. And one of the reasons why we're discussing it now is that it has come into the presidential campaign. And I would say that Donald Trump, maybe inarticulately, has brought the issue of what's happening in Chicago far more to the forefront of discussion than the President of the United States. And we have people on this program who have criticized Barack Obama because this was happening in his hometown, and he was not using the bully pulpit of his office to do something about it.
So, Bruce, here's a point, and here's
does everybody agree with that?
I agree.
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely we agree, but to Kevin's question, part of that problem is the black community not demanding what it should demand. I am so sick.
Who should it demand? I agree with you, but who should it demand to? Because
political leaders.
There
mayor,
are marches.
The governor. Damn a march.
Thank you.
Damn a march. You're doing it. We're doing it the wrong way.
Yes,
you cannot continue to take a teddy bear and a candle and a balloon to the site of the crime and march on it. You cannot continue to do that and say that we are going to solve the problem. That is not coming up with a solution to the problem.
Everybody's nodding to what you're saying.
As a member of the Metro Board of the Chicago Urban League, just last week I hosted a Black Lives Matter panel with some very strong leaders across this city, including some elected officials. One of the most interesting things that came out of that panel was that not a single person there would mention the violence that is going on within our own communities that are perpetrated our own people that look like us.
Thank you.
At the end of the day, you can hold as many signs, march until your shoes have holes in them. That's not affecting policy. What we have is a lack of understanding as to how to drive policy change. We have people who consistently vote for things that are social service supports, but do not get out and vote for things that would be able to alleviate some of the crimes within their communities. That means
Donald Trump change things? He says, what the hell do you have to lose? What is your answer to that question?
The question
Trump
is not
pointing out the problems. He's pointing out the problems, and he's using a very loud mouth.
And he says he's
going
to cure it in a week, which is a bunch of BS.
He's not coming up with – he's saying you don't have anything to lose, but he's not saying what do we have to gain. Mm-hmm. That's what he's not – that's what's missing from his from his rhetoric.
If Donald Trump –
Neither of them, right, including the President of the United States, has a urban program. No one is addressing these problems with solutions. Exactly. Money is solutions. Jobs are solutions. Black enterprise is a solution to some of the problems that we're having. No one. Black community at large in America needs a Marshall Plan.
There you go.
Black people are also
not
forcefully pushing for it.
And we're not pushing for it.
Right.
That's right.
If I had a kid that was killed and you came up with a teddy bear and a balloon for me, give me a break. I would shoot somebody.
Well, don't do that.
Our disunity in the African-American community, that's what's hurting us right now. I just want to be clear. I said this earlier on the show. Everybody's in response mode. We come after somebody gets shot. We have to stop doing that. We have to be more proactive
Facebook.
And preventive and stop it before it happens. On behalf of Violence Interrupters, my staff this year already stopped 25 potential homicides on the front end.
How do you do it?
Because I know people on the streets that call my staff, and they may call me, it's about to go down, I need you to go over here and talk to some people for me. And we talk to the guys, and I've said this before.
But how do
you're
you,
not going
to
stop
what
a killer.
Let me just say this.
You are not going to stop a killer nowhere in the United States unless you know the killer and you have a relationship with that killer, where that person will listen to you. And what I say to them, think about your life. Think about your kids, your grandmother, and your family that worked hard to get you where you are today, and put that gun down. Let's work this out, because that guy you want to shoot, he's just like you.
In recent weeks, the new police chief in Chicago, Eddie Johnson, who is an African-American for those around the country, he says basically they know the people who are going to commit the crimes. These happen in about three or four police districts, primarily on the west side, some on the south side as well. So he knows that the common denominator of the people that are going to do these shootings. And for a couple of weekends, he went out and did a massive roundup of those people. Now, Is that a good idea?
Let me say this.
Why is it not a good idea?
And my question would also be, for everybody who has camera phones and can snap and take all types of video footage of police officers shooting somebody, where are those same people when we have people in our communities who look like us who are going up and down the block shooting people?
And where's Black Lives Matter? Where's that march? Where's the Black Lives Matter marching?
You ask a very good question, and we've talked about, there's been a lot written about, you know, about the code blue silence, where cops don't talk about. You're bringing up a very important point. Black people are being killed by black people, and other black people aren't letting, they're not even giving the description of the shooter.
The list superintendent talks about the 1,400 individuals that are driving the violence, okay?
Yes.
He should produce that list and give that list to organizations like Violence Interrupters, some organizations. Let us work with them young men. During my career, I've hired over 300 ex-offenders and helped turn their lives around. They become productive members of society. I know how to get to those guys that are shooters. I know how to get to guys with mental health issues, psychotic behavior. That's what I'm talking about. That's part of the solution.
When you go out, I want to go out with you someday.
No, you
want to go ride in the car.
1-800-7. I've done a ride along with police. Cool. I think right. I'm going to do a ride along with you. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. Lots of calls when we come back from Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We've been monopolizing the conversation here. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's go to Fred, listening to us in North Carolina on XM Satellite Radio. And Fred, what city or town are you calling from?
I'm calling from Quinjock, North Carolina.
Where's that located?
Just north of Nagstead. It's on the Intercoastal Waterway.
Okay, very good. How can we help you tonight?
All right, so I understand the conversation because, I mean, this same conversation has been going on. I'm 52 years old, and I honestly don't remember a moment in my conscious memory that we haven't been having this conversation, and it's valid to a certain degree. But going back to 16, 19, I got nothing. You know, what I do got is at what point does this end? You know, we talk about Black Lives Matter, but like the young lady said, the black people don't value their own lives. We talk about, you know, underprivileged, impoverished, you know, how people have been screwed. We talk about slavery in 1619, but we don't talk about how black people used to own slaves. We talk about, you know, how the government has screwed people. Let me tell you something. The government has screwed Native Americans 100,000 times worse, and they seem to have thrived. And I believe my daughter is going to see the extermination of the Native American community. You know, I mean, literally. I mean, the Chinese got screwed in the 1800s because they... You know, my point I'm getting at is everybody's been screwed. Get over it. You know, I mean, the thing is here's the bottom line is Black Lives Matter wants black people to stop being shot. That'll never happen. You know, I don't care. I mean, we could all get around in a circle, hold hands, sing King Kumbaya and swap sticks. It's people is from the day of Adam and Eve. People have been killing people. And I hate to say that, and it sounds callous, but I mean, it sucks. But how does this conversation end? Because
all right, let's Fred, stay on the line. I'm going to give you the last word, but I'm going to let everybody respond to your thoughts. Let's start with Amisha.
There was a lot going on in that statement. First and foremost, thanks for the call. I think that we have to have a recognition that there's a lot going on within the African-American communities, particularly. And I think that when you combine that with the Native American history that you spoke of, you also have to have the recognition that there has been a conscious effort economically to make sure that several Native Americans would be fined. If you're looking at the casinos in the southern region in the United States, you're looking at the payments directly given towards them as a population. There is nothing comparable whatsoever within the African American community. And if you're talking about violence, generally speaking, overall, yes, violence is something that has occurred throughout human history. And nobody is disagreeing with that point. What we are saying, though, and what the point of this whole conversation was, that there is a real epidemic and a very strong problem within certain communities of color right now. And we're trying to find ways that we can actually alleviate and diminish a lot of what's going on there. Not saying that at any given point, violence is going to be gone entirely, but we can see reductions in those numbers.
Teal Hardeman.
One thing I would say, you made the comment, just get over it. That hit me there, because the reality is you can't just get over something that's been systemic. I'm talking about for generations to come, and it's still existing today.
20 generations.
So that's like telling like somebody that's been abused time and time again, and then an adult now, and you say, just get over it. It's not that easy.
He is saying that other groups have done that,
however. We don't know that for sure. I mean, we really don't know that. A lot of people are still struggling. I can only speak on behalf of the African-American community. Drugs were planted in our community. We know that, okay? We know about
But a lot of people don't acknowledge that.
They don't acknowledge it, right.
You believe that, but not a lot of knowledge.
The Jim Crow laws, okay? Post-slavery, pre-slavery,
You're stating the problem. His question was, how do you get over it?
Well, Native Americans are still having many, many problems on their reservations. And in fact, Native American youth are shot more by police than African Americans, which is a statistic that many of us are unaware of.
And they have a problem of alcoholism, which is not made up. It's not stereotype. It's a reality in the community.
Absolutely. And many communities do have lingering effects of ongoing discrimination. But the people that he talks about, they came here with intact cultures. African Americans essentially were created by American slavery. The only reason we're here is to tote that barge and lift that bale. That's the only reason African Americans are here. And so we were created by the situation in which we were placed.
But how do you get over it? Fred's point is it's 150 years ago.
We've never really attempted to get over it. That's the problem. We're still trying to convince white Americans that there is a problem. As we hear from this cat who just called in, he said we have to get over it. It's not that easy.
Right.
I think we've been trying to get over it, and I think the American solutions are education and economics. You just saw about 2 weeks ago Georgetown admit to slavery. That the Jesuits had participated in, and that the school now wants to do. How many years ago was that? That was about 100 years ago,
right.
And they just got to the we admit that there was a problem, and today we want to do something about it.
They're only one of hundreds.
Of hundreds that they want to do it. The same thing applies to Harvard. The same thing applies to Yale. I think what you have to look at is we talk about other folks got over it. We have had laws to prevent us from getting over it, from getting married, from being able to read, from going to school.
But that's a while ago. That's a while ago. I want to speak to one thing that you talked about. I want to speak to one thing you talked about. And I'm wondering whether this is the common denominator. You said that the black community, they're not unified, or they can't agree. They can't agree on what the problems were. You just said that education. Is education and the access to a quality education in a classroom without violence, that seems to me to be a basic thing that everyone should agree to get to. But again, when you talk about giving students, whether they're black students or white students, choice in where they go to school and going for quality education, this becomes a debatable point. You have one party that wants to do it. You got another party that doesn't want to do it. You're involved in this. You're involved in charter schools. So,
right.
Again, that's your background.
That
you're speaking
there's
with
a bent here.
There's
but
a little bias
I will
here.
Also say that when it comes to education, the bottom line should be, regardless of what political arena you are in or where you fall on that spectrum, the best education, the best quality for a child. What we see happening is that there is a concerted effort by liberals, which I am one myself, to honestly work towards providing for community schools, even if those community schools have shattered communities over time and actually have more students dropping out, more students not being able to read and write, even when you have charter schools or when you have magnet schools within the same community that are doing a lot better. And a lot of that is because the argument is we're fighting over a small portion of students, and everyone knows that where that student goes, there are tax dollars, there are state dollars to go with that student.
They're also there in this particular case. It seems to me that you have two great constituencies of the Democratic Party. We're going to getting into the Trump position here. Mm-hmm. You've got the labor union constituency, and you have the African American constituency. And in this particular case, on this particular subject, it seems to me that the powers that be in the Democratic Party are a lot more concerned about keeping their labor house in order. And because they can't see the correlation between bad teachers being protected by public service unions, primarily teachers union in large cities, and that's why they keep producing bad students or students that don't know anything.
Labor union funds the party. Those unions are some of the strongest political advocates in the nation.
So where are people getting riled up about that fact?
It is insane for America's society to have the problems that we have with education at this time. It's absolutely insanity.
I agree.
And it's insanity because Johnny ought to be able to read, whether he is poor, rich, black, white. Third grade reading is third grade reading no matter what.
Yes.
That's the way it ought to be. By the time you put the politics, there's more politics in education than it is at City Hall. By the time you play these political games with these kids, a charter school or a Catholic school or this kind of school or that kind of school, the kids lose. You close the schools. You close 50 schools. Insane. We've got some insanity going on in our education. There is no bad student. There are some bad teachers. And our system is producing some bad results. There
but
should
the
be
system
no difference.
Is protecting bad teachers. That's the problem.
It's called tenure.
The example of that is sending the lighting the candle and setting the teddy bear. It doesn't work.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
And we're teaching. Here's the other thing, Bruce. We're also teaching antiquated ways. See, that's part of the problem. Nobody gets into curriculum. You cannot go to the blackboard and teach Johnny ABCs anymore. Johnny comes to school saying ABCs. What size font do you want? That's how he's coming to school now, and we're still teaching some antiquated ways.
Our poor black kids aren't coming with. They're coming with phones.
Yes.
They're coming with phones.
Well, that's a
phones
positive.
And games.
I was just going to say,
Fred. Last word to you, and then we're going to move on. Fred,
I appreciate it. Thank you for everybody's comment. The point that I'm trying to get to is not to offend, but what I'm saying is this conversation has been going on for 50 years.
That's true.
And we still have great.
Okay. That's thanks true. For your call. Calumet City, Tony is the caller. Go ahead. You're on the air, Tony.
I just want to say a couple of things. I think you all have great points, but I think that there are two main issues that affect African Americans today. The history is true, and it has its relevance. But William Wilson, a professor at social policy at Harvard. I'm sure some of you know who he is.
Yes.
He wrote a book called When Work Disappeared. And that really is the crux of the problem in the black community. They can have all the child care, pre-K programs they want. But when that little child comes home all excited and he's faced with a father that's not working and a dysfunctional family, and the other part is drugs. Drugs that have come into our community and literally destroyed it. Now, I am a Hillary Clinton supporter. However, I have enough sense to see why Trump is being very effective, because he is telling people that this drug situation that's now affecting whites in New Hampshire and Ohio and other places are bringing their communities down to the same level that
Tony, we thank you for your call. I've got to run. Good call, but we've got to run.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travel, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and I want to, before we go too much further, I want to talk a little bit about, obviously it's a political show, we want to talk about the recent attempts by Donald Trump to reach out to the African-American community, and the most recent attempt was his announcement a few days ago, basically reversing himself on the birther issue, saying that Barack Obama was born in the United States. And I want to get reaction because, actually, Hermaine, you're on the program this evening because a couple of weeks ago, we're old friends, but you were on Fox News, and you were making a point in the context of Donald Trump's efforts to reach out to African Americans, and you were trying to make a point, but they weren't giving you much airtime to make that point. So I want you to make the point now, and then I want to expand the discussion in this segment of the show and talk about how realistic is it that Donald Trump could get some respect and maybe a few African-American votes.
So the point that I was making was that with Donald Trump, which he has brought a new phenomena into the world of politics, win, lose, Democrat, Republican, he's brought a new phenomena into the world. Media is not holding Donald Trump responsible or accountable. Donald Trump is playing free association. Whatever comes to his mind, he says it. So when he says Barack Obama does not have, it was not born in the U.S., I saw no media say, why do you say that? Can you prove that? What is your evidence? Do you have documentation? We've had a 5-year discussion on that. It is ridiculous. It is a stupid conversation. Now, the media is reporting on Donald Trump no matter what. Anything he says, they report. We are looking at an infomercial. We are looking at a soap opera of Donald Trump, Donald Trump, and Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump is the master of reality TV, and we are now at reality politics. And my question is, where's accountability from the media? From the media. Where's accountability and responsibility? You would not, if Barack Obama would have said a fraction, just a fraction of what Donald Trump has said, he would probably be in an insane asylum.
But on that, particular program, you were talking about, because Donald Trump had said that the crime in Chicago could end in a week.
Because he had talked to somebody. And my point was, Donald Trump has a responsibility to tell us how that can be done. It's not who he talked to, because I don't think he talked to anybody, right. But he said he did, so I'll give him his due respect. Okay, fine. But what did you talk about, and how can you, how could it be solved? You need to tell us.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, and I've said that on this program. I think other media people have said it as well. If you know how to stop crime in Chicago in 1 week, again, we've got another 6 to 8 weeks before the election day. You could save a lot of lives if
tell
us what tell it is
us
right
what
now.
To do.
Now, Salim, the last time you were on the show, you kind of surprised me, because you were talking about your audience on WVON. You have a show on Sunday, Saturday night. And you were saying you were surprised by the number of callers to your show who are favorably impressed with Donald Trump.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons. Some of them favor him because they think that black people will be shocked into a reality of forcing them to do for self, to do more enterprising things, since we have this enemy in our midst. So that's one reason why they want him. I often remind them that I heard a lot of people say that about Ronald Reagan as well, and we're still trying to recover from Reaganomics. But that's part of their argument. But there are many folks who call my show who say that Trump would be good for the African-American community because of he's honest. He's saying things that a lot of black people say themselves, and he's putting it into the public discourse. And that's, you know.
He's been criticized because he's been giving these speeches primarily to white audiences.
That's because he's trying to attract white suburban women. That's his target.
Mm-hmm. But he also gave the speech in Detroit, so there was primarily an African-American audience there. But my question to you is, he has spent in the last, let's say, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, he has spent more time talking about African-American-related issues than any Republican candidate I can remember in the last 50 years.
Except Jack Kemp.
Except Jack Kemp, right.
Except Nixon.
Well, I believe Donald
Trump. That was over 40 years ago.
I believe Donald Trump's voice needs to be heard. He's running for president the same way Hillary Clinton's voice needs to be heard. There shouldn't be a big difference there, but I don't think he's going to gain any traction in the African-American community. Not because he's a Republican. It's because Donald Trump just does not appear to be sincere about knowing anything about the African-American community. That he needs to do some research on some of the issues in the African-American community for real, and then he can address those issues. And last but not least, I think the only reason he's running for president is because of his jealousy of Barack Obama. Sincerely, because he's been a critic of Barack Obama.
What are the issues that you think he should be addressing that have not yet been addressed?
How is he going to address discrimination in the African-American community, poor education, the violence issue, which he never brought forth no solution about it, okay?
He did talk about the school choice as far as the education issue.
What is he going to do about it?
He has not addressed the issue of mass incarceration.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. He needs to address those issues and put forth a plan. That's what I'm talking about.
I think Donald Trump is very adept at a few things. First and foremost, being able to read his audience. And I think that when it comes to the African-American population, he has spent enough time understanding what are the pulse pushers for African-Americans. He gets it when you're talking about economy and jobs. Whether or not he's created an essential plan around how he's going to make that work and make it more equitable for black people isn't a part of his rhetoric right now. But the fact that jobs is a major issue is. The fact that violence in our communities is. The fact that there are some issues when it comes to police brutality is. What he's done in many ways is be able to sit down and have a conversation and pinpoint the five top issues for African-Americans today. And at the end of the day, if you've been following his campaign at any given point, that's all he's done with a variety of demographics. Mm-hmm. He's not going to break down exactly how these policies are going to affect or exactly how he's going to make them actionable.
Even though it was not specifically targeted to African American women, the speech this past week about family leave and about tax credits for young mothers, how did that appeal to the women that you know?
I think that it appealed very strongly because the women that I know, they are working moms. They are people who will not take off work when they have kids because they can't. They are women who, in large part, if you're talking about minority women, women who the man is not there. So they know that they don't have the opportunity to sit back. They're going to have to figure this thing out and they're going to have to keep going.
Will black women listen to him?
I think they're listening. Will they support him is a different story.
But actually, the plan that Trump came up with for families to take off child care, That's a good thing. Black women would benefit from that. That is better and more than $15 an hour.
Right.
If you can take
and,
that
and
deduction.
Just as important as education.
And
I
just
think.
As important as education. That is very, very major. That was a good plan. I think.
But again, here's my question.
Okay.
Are blacks going to give him a chance?
I mean, maybe
he is saying the words, and I agree with you. Yeah. Whether or not he believes it or not, whether or not when he reads certain statements, like he read the birther statement, he's reading it off a card. Whether that's from the heart, probably not. But the reality is,
Kellyanne Conway's playbook.
He is saying the words. Are people going to give him a chance that he might be the guy?
It doesn't
Maybe
matter.
He is a guy like Nixon who was very liberal with minority issues.
It doesn't matter whether it's from the heart. It was stupid in the first place, all right? And the media...
which was stupid?
The birthing thing, though.
But
it was stupid in the first place, and the media supported it. I blame the media more than I blame Trump.
Although the media never gave that any.
Well, that, yes, was, they a, did. That was also a Republican.
They told the story, but I don't think they were saying.
It never should have been reported.
Yeah.
If you don't have evidence.
If somebody says that you
Barack Obama was not born in the United States.
The president was slow to come up with this.
But let's be honest here. At the end of the day, the average African American isn't voting on whether or not Donald Trump supports
her. They do not care.
It doesn't affect them
every
day.
Whether Obama was born in Nigeria or Hawaii.
That's my point. No, that is not an issue. The issue of whether or not someone can get child care or family leave, that's what they're going to talk about.
That's right.
Are there going to be jobs? Now, here's something else that he has talked about. In his immigration speech, he's made the point that African Americans can be some of the big losers because of the illegal immigrants that come to the country.
Let me say
Is that something you agree with?
I'm not anti-Trump. I want to make that clear. But I believe that Trump waited too late to reach out to the African American
community.
But here's
the point. On the issue of illegal immigration, are there African Americans watching and listening to this show this evening who believe they might have lost a job or they don't get a job because illegal immigrants are coming in and they're working cheaper?
African-American people are so caught up in that.
A good 98% of the African-American population, I would argue, do.
I agree. I think it's one of the reasons Chuy Garcia didn't fare well in the African
American. Say it again.
I think that's one of the reasons that mayoral candidate Chuy Garcia didn't fare well in the election is because of that animosity that many black people have toward Latinos.
Whether or not that's historically or statistically true.
But this is important. By the way, for those listening around the country, Chuy Garcia ran for mayor, Mexican, and make the point, because in context, that's a very important point you make.
Yeah, he was running he was running for mayor, and he was an alternative to Rahm Emanuel, who a lot of black people were against. Yet, when it came down to the election, a lot of black people didn't support Chuy Garcia. They chose to support Rahm Emanuel
because they thought that he would give favorable treatment to
Latinos
and over blacks,
over African Americans. And there was this lingering animosity in the black community about that.
All right, and you were saying the same thing.
Yeah, I was just at a city council meeting last week, and that was one of the outbursts. So I will say that there are a lot of minorities, specifically African Americans, who feel as though that is a real issue when it comes to jobs, especially those labor jobs, those blue collar jobs being shipped off to someplace else, or the ones that actually exist here being filled with people who don't look like them, being filled with people who will work for less. So I don't think that that's an arguable point.
But Trump's Trump's connection with the alt-right is not a good look for African Americans.
He's not a perfect candidate. We all know he's not a perfect candidate. 1-800-723-8029. We got lots of callers from California to Texas to South Carolina, and we'll be back with them when we roll on with our final segment from Chicago.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head southwest to El Paso, Texas. Jorge is listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead, Jorge.
Bruce, out of my belief, I believe that African Americans, out of their need, have been treated badly, out of resentment by the greater community, and that in order to alleviate that, they're going to have to vote different, and I suspect that in not doing so, that they'll continue to be treated badly. And if they were to vote differently, then they would gain that respect that they otherwise are not receiving. And if they were to vote differently, especially African-American male, if he were to vote differently, I would benefit too as African, not as an African-American, but as an American-Hispanic, because the American-Hispanic is dependent on the well-being of the African-American, is what I believe.
I'm going to get everybody a response to that. I'm going to start with you because you are the most politically active. You ran for governor of Illinois in the Democratic primary. You did not make it, but you've run. So you're politically astute, politically active. Is there a case to be made that Donald Trump is making that the Democrats have put way too much in the basket of the Democratic Party?
Well,
No, Donald Trump is making a clear, you know, he's sending a clear message, in other words. The Democrats have definitely let down African-American people in a lot of ways. People do not want to talk about it. I'm a Democrat, but I'm saying this on your show today because I looked at the facts out there. The Democratic Party has promised the African-American community the world, and we still have high unemployment. We have all these issues out here. You have all these Democratic politicians running around the city right now talking about violence, but not one of them have come up with a solution to end the violence in the community. And that's why I said it on this particular tonight, because we have to think out of the box right now. Maybe there's a time to think about going another direction.
There's a disproportion to the loyalty and the strength of the vote that the African-American voter at large has given to the Democratic Party and what we have received.
Well, last night, addressing the Black Caucus, the president made the strongest statement in a very demonstrative way that the African Americans, if they cared about his legacy, go out and vote because he wants Hillary Clinton to follow him. He does not want to be embarrassed by Donald Trump.
That's the party line, and that's exactly what he's supposed to say. And right. And that was the strongest black statement
right.
that President Obama has made since he's been in office. He was a black man. That was the black president last night. That was the black president who happened to be Democrat. Yeah. It wasn't a Democrat who happened to be black.
I have to, you know, defer to a lot of my callers who say, "Wait, you know, what is your legacy?"
There you go. That's the question. What is your legacy?
Well, what have blacks really gained from your tenure? African Americans are worse off statistically than they were, to a greater extent.
Why would you be insulted if we did not vote because you've insulted us because you have not delivered?
And haven't used the bully pulpit to make our case.
That's right.
So that's what a lot of them say. I offer the caveat. Well, you know, we have to also consider what may have occurred had Romney or McCain been elected. We may have been much worse than we are now. So there is that. But that's arguing in the negative and the you know, surmising things, and that
we have to also reshape expectations and look at the fact that with all the goodwill President Obama may have had for the black community, he also has to go through Congress, and we did watch that mm-hmm, flip during his time in office.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Also, there has yet to be a quintessential black agenda. So if the argument is going to consistently be Barack Obama didn't deliver this or the Democratic Party didn't deliver this, then I'm going to need black community members, black community leaders, black elected officials at the local level to actually develop policy and a political agenda that will change the outcomes for black Americans. Until that is done, then I don't care if the president is libertarian, Republican, Democrat, or any of the others. You're not going to see change.
Let me say something to your point. Abraham Lincoln, greatest president of the United States, the idol of Barack Obama, freed the slaves on executive order.
Mm.
Right. Not Congress. He did not have congressional vote. Executive order freed slaves.
Plus, a lot of the Democratic rhetoric has no substance when it comes down to reducing violence, especially here in Chicago. And the reason I'm saying Democrats, because Democrats control
everything.
You know, everything. So they need to stop talking and go to work, roll their sleeves up and go to work. And it's incumbent upon the African-American community to help stop the violence in their community.
One thing also, by the way, for those around the country, just a little Chicago or Cook County, which is that's Chicago, around third largest county in the United States. The political record in the Chicagoland area is when African-Americans have formed an alliance with Republicans at the county level, they have had success. They've had success in electing sheriffs. They've had success in electing state's attorneys. It goes back several years. They certainly were involved in overthrowing an incumbent Democratic state's attorney because of her alleged misdeeds in the Laquan McDonald case. But again, in previous years, in the last 40 years, there was a black Republican coalition that changed politics in Cook County. Dave in Royal Oaks, California, listening to us on satellite radio tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air.
First thing, I'm incensed by your statement that Nixon was a racial liberal. Clearly, he implemented affirmative action program because he was a politician. We know from his papers and his insiders that he freely used the N-word, and he presided over the FBI's COINTELPRO program that assassinated Fred Hampton in Chicago, locked up Geronimo DiGiacomo Pratt as a political prisoner for 30 years in California, and fomented strife between U.S. blacks and the Black Panther Party in L.A., causing two students to be murdered on a UCLA campus. He was not a, good racial guy. He was a bigot. I'm surprised your panel didn't challenge you on that. To today's topic, I'm offended by the way that Trump himself and the Republican Party says to black people, you should vote for us, without extending programs to us or changing their rhetoric.
I agree.
I'm sure you've seen the ANES study from 2012, and on their poll, they had two racial questions. One was, do you think blacks are less industrious, lazier than whites? Do you think blacks are less intelligent than whites? 69% of Americans judge blacks to be less than whites on one or both of those two scales. The highest correlation to voting for the Republican Party is where you, if you score black lower on that scale.
That's right.
Dave, on that note, we're cutting you off, not because of the quality of your call, because it was a good call, but again, we are out of time for our broadcast. But thank you very much for calling. Our thanks to all of our guests this evening. Great discussion. Our thanks to Colin Bobbitt and Dan Dorfman and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amling's now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.